Hello and welcome to Tales from Imperial Russia with Dr. James White. Episode 26, Spectres of Empire, the Tale of Father Ioan Solovyov. Things were going bump in the night in Lichensi, a tiny hamlet 130 miles northeast of Moscow. Father Ioan Solovyov, an Orthodox cleric respected despite his history of alcohol abuse, suddenly found his living quarters filled with acrid smoke. Investigating his stove, he discovered that the chimney had been inexplicably bunged up with a sack, felt, sheepskin, and a miscellany of household objects. This was only the beginning of the perplexing goings-on. Other items began randomly vanishing and appearing in the strangest of places. The fire of the stove began lighting itself. Thoroughly disturbed, the priest naturally first turned to prayer, encountering an exorcism. O Lord, thou who hast driven off legions of demons, command the deaf and the mute devil and the unclean force who holds on here to go out of the person, never to return. Lord, thou art above all evil and temptation. Stand by all the creatures in this house. Relieve them of nocturnal fear, of the arrows flying during the day, of the things that wander about in darkness, of the terror and of the noon demon, so that your male servants, your women servants, and the children be granted thy help and for protection of the angel troop, so that they may all in agreement and unison sing, "The Lord is my helper." But whatever mischievous force had taken residency in the Solovyov household evidently had little respect for the rites of the church. Ghostly hands sprinkled flour over the assembled worshippers and moved its attention from everyday items to holy objects, casting to the floor of the Bible, a crucifix, and the priest's vestments. Even church paperwork was insufficiently sacred to perturb the sprite, which magically caused an ink blot in the shape of a naked hunchback woman to manifest in the parish records. Next, Solovyov turned to his parishioners for help, asking them to guard his domicile from the malevolence raging in the ether. The peasant Ivan Mikhailov patrolled at night, only to be assailed by a cat-like creature that fell on him as soon as he investigated, tapping from the stove. On closer inspection, it turned out to be nothing more than a kerchief, although Ivan connected the beast's transformation into harmless apparel through his quick decision to make the sign of the cross. But less explicable was how, as Ivan disrobed for sleep, his hat and trousers were cast to the floor, while his coat was ripped. A disembodied voice warned him to get out of the way. The local woman, Martha Larionova, recounted similar scenes of disturbing domestic disorder.
I saw chairs turned upside down in the living room, the sewing machine on the floor, two desk lamps were also standing on the floor. When I went from the living room to the next room, I smelled something burning. People were standing by the stove door. The peasant Anna Zakharova opened the door in front of my eyes and we saw that the fire inside the stove wasn't burning with flames, but with sparks, as if the cardigans inside the stove were sparkling. I got the cardigans out with my bare hands and threw them onto the floor. I feared that the clothing hanging nearby would catch fire and I therefore threw them back into the stove, but I didn't burn my hands.
Unusual sounds, magical fires, strange voices. But this was not all. Father Solovyov soon found his own bed violated. Lying awake one night, he felt a gigantic fleshy lump form next to him. So terrified he refused to look lest he die of fright, Solovyov ever so cautiously felt the coarse mass with his left hand and moved some of it onto his chest. But when he anxiously glanced, he saw only his right hand. Enough was enough. Solovyov now sent two telegrams beseeching prayer and assistance, one to his bishop and the other to the eminent Father Ioan Sergeyev of Kronstadt, the empire's most famous preacher and an alleged miracle worker. Meanwhile, reporting on the incident in the local church gazette was rapidly repeated in the empire's most popular daily newspapers and a range of cheap pamphlets, bringing a motley host of journalists to Solovyov's door. The local governor dispatched a representative, and the police began an investigation. It seemed as though all the empire was agog to hear about events in Lichensi, an otherwise unknown rural corner populated by under 300 people. The spectral happenings in Lichensi were not the first ghostly apparitions to capture Russian imaginations at the end of the 19th century. Indeed, the haunted house had become something of a favourite in the penny dreadfuls and tabloids of the empire. Fervent fans of the unexplained and the occult might have been struck by the similarities between the Lichensi case and another haunting in Kazan in 1884. Here, one Mr. Florentsov, a retired military man, had found himself and his household assailed by the dread apparition of flying potatoes. Reasonably alarmed, Florentsov got some old army buddies involved. One journalist, tongue firmly in cheek, reported, "One officer was hit by a potato on his head, another one on his nose. Some were hit by the bullets of this invisible foe at their backs, shoulders, and so on. The potato bombardment continued, and one of the rank and file received such a severe blow that he was beaten off his feet by fear. However, the soldiers endured the potato fire and calmly collected the shells, eating some of them on the battlefield, thus making the most of the fact that many of them were cooked." Another notorious case took place in Petersburg province, where the well-to-do peasant Theodosia Spilidonova suddenly heard knocking on her windows. The religious images used to try and counter this perturbance seemed to only enrage the spirit concerned, as the icons were flung down and knives began to be driven into the floor. In what is today Chernihiv, in Ukraine, a priest found dolls mysteriously placed next to all members of the household as they slept. Following a round of flying objects and a misbehaving stove, the concerned clergyman called in a monk famed for his ascetic rejection of all female company to perform an exorcism, but this only provided the spirit with an opportunity for reborn mockery, as a female doll suddenly appeared and bowed before the flummoxed monastic. What conclusions did participants, journalists, and readers reach when confronting these and other instances of the paranormal? There was a plentiful repository of magical explanations to be found in peasant folklore. On the benign side of things, there were the domovoi, or house spirits, small, furry creatures that acted both as protectors of the household and nocturnal pranksters, knocking on furniture and pinching bottoms when not properly appeased. Their homes were normally the warm, cosy corners presented by stovetops. Far darker were beliefs in witchcraft and demonic possession, still prevalent amidst the peasantry by the beginning of the 20th century. Listeners are advised to turn to episode 8, wherein I discuss how mass demonic possession in a Russian village in the 1890s turned violent. For our purposes today, note how Father Ioan Solovyov and the priest in Chernihiv province both tried to rid themselves of their invisible troubles by performing exorcisms, an explicit church endorsement of the reality of demonic possession. Additionally, in Solovyov's case, it was rumoured that his former servant, fired and imprisoned for theft thanks to the pastor's denunciations, had turned to a sorcerer to be revenged on her erstwhile employer. However, for the increasingly discerning and secular readership of the late empire, belief in the physical reality of either domovoi or demons was in decline, replaced by explanations that focused either on fraud or mental affliction. But this ever more common disenchantment of the world did not eliminate mystical or magical readings of haunted houses. Indeed, popular and widespread were spiritualism and the occult, especially since the practitioners of these arts had long been concerned to dress them in the veneer of science and rationality. Note that the first conclusion jumped to by the police officer investigating Father Solovyov's haunting was that the priest's current maidservant was a practicing spirit medium. The constable argued that the maid had effectively brought a spirit from another world to haunt the priest's home. Such arguments had considerable social and cultural resonance. Russian society, like others in Europe at the end of the 19th century, had been fascinated by the notion of mediums, seances and spirits for some decades. The seance was brought to Russia in 1858 by the Scottish-American medium Daniel Douglas Hume, who married Emperor Alexander II's goddaughter Alexandra Kroll. Hume's repeated visits to Russia over the next 20 years were always accompanied by mediumistic sessions performed for the benefit of the empire's most upper of crusts. Emperor Alexander II himself twice participated in Hume's parlour magic. What transformed Hume from an aristocratic eccentric into a household name were events in 1871. With his first wife dying a decade earlier, Hume married the sister-in-law of the eminent Russian chemist Alexander Butlerov, known not only for his revolutionary discovery of formaldehyde, but also for his championing of women's education. Hume invited his new relative to attend a séance, which quickly won over the chemist. Hume was similarly able to convert Butlerov's kinsman, Alexander Aksakov, a publicist member of the Aksakov clan famed for their Slavophile philosophy, and Butlerov's old university classmate, Nikolai Wagner, an award-winning academic zoologist. Butlerov, Aksakov and Wagner set themselves the assignment of both promoting mediums amidst educated Russian society and attempting to provide a rational, physical explanation of the strange events that they observed during séances. The three men regularly took a panoply of scientific instrumentation to these sessions to provide a host of data on things like temperature and air pressure. They definitively succeeded in their first task. Séances and mediums assumed an ever-widening sphere of popularity over the next few decades, with endless manuals of varying quality advising groups from all classes and educational levels about how to perform séances and what items were needed. More than 30 journals and newspapers specifically dedicated to spiritualist and occultist subjects were published over the final decades of the empire, ranging from the serious and expensive Rebus, released initially in 1881 as a family riddle magazine, to the cheaper and much more ribald Spiritualist, closed in 1912 when its editor rejected spiritualism in favour of traditional orthodox theology. Meanwhile, both theatre stages and private dining rooms were trod by a growing ensemble of celebrity mediums, such as the Polish tanner Jan Guzik, who summoned notoriously violent spirits capable of punching people and inflicting serious injury. By the end of the empire, one finds individuals as diverse as the decadent poet Valery Brusov, the famous World War I general Alexei Brusilov, and the murderer of Rasputin, Prince Felix Yusupov, participating ardently in séances. Fyodor Dostoevsky, author of Crime and Punishment, publicized the activities of one Polish medium supposedly capable of summoning spirits who could tie knots in a previously sealed length of rope. But of course, perhaps not even most of the people who attended or conducted such occult activities actually bought into their reality. For many, they were just an element of dinner party entertainment, a thrilling brush with a world both mysterious and forbidden. Simply sitting in a darkened room and holding hands with a stranger was in itself a potentially titillating exercise. The aforementioned poet Brusov Eustace is to systematically grope the object of his affections. For others, seances were a source of comfort, either as a confirmation of some kind of immortality, or as a way of reaching out to deceased loved ones. Other occult practices offered the allure of physical benefits and mental self-improvement. Hypnosis is the prime example. Already by the 1880s, members of the medical and psychiatric professions were seriously investigating hypnosis as a treatment for an array of persistent behaviours and personality disorders. Of particular interest were hypnotism's potential use in stemming alcoholism and criminality. On the more vulgar level, self-help guides offered hypnotism as a means for developing a force or personality capable of overcoming the wills of others. While this was mostly meant in the positive sense of helping people to become more self-assertive in an increasingly competitive world, there certainly were media panics that hypnosis might be used for malign purposes, such as by Lothario's seeking to bed young women. In 1913, a media storm was fomented by the idea that foreign agents were using hypnotism to force otherwise patriotic Russians into committing acts of espionage. All this encouraged the state first to demand that all practitioners of hypnosis carry a medical license, and then, in 1891, to ban hypnosis for entertainment purposes. Not that this particularly stopped diligent celebrity specialists, such as the French-born L. Honoré, who was arrested in 1911 for illegal hypnosis sessions. Of course, this is somewhat ironic, given that the state itself was victim to the most famous example of baleful hypnosis in imperial history, that allegedly practiced by Grigory Rasputin on Emperor Nicholas II and his wife Alexandra. As successful as Butlerov, Aksakov and Wagner were in propagating spiritualism and its associated practices, they proved far less adept at proving its scientific bona fides. As early as the 1870s, the free men incurred the wrath of the chemist Dmitri Mendeleev, today most famous for his invention of the periodic table. Incensed by their attempts to provide scientific legitimacy to mere parlour games, Mendeleev conducted a whole press campaign to discredit their research on spiritualism. In response, the trio personally attacked Mendeleev, calling him a cantankerous tyrant. Butlerov, in particular, got himself into trouble when he began to theorise about spiritualism in terms of higher geometry, arguing that the instances observed during seances were evidence of fourth-dimensional beings operating in the third dimension. Butlerov's writings were perceived as an attack on the validity and reliability of geometry as a science. This carried a particular political twist, with some stating that by undermining science, Butlerov was in fact undermining the forces of progress in the Russian Empire, and would, through his proclamation of occultism, bring about the collapse of society and its descent into obscurantism. From the opposite end of the political spectrum, the Russian Orthodox Church too was concerned. While it might agree with the spiritualist claims about the immortality of the soul, the Church and its theologians understood this immortality in a very different way, just as it understood miracles as God's intervention in the world, and not simply the acts of fourth-dimensional beings. Consequently, most church thinkers denounced spiritualism and its practices as verging on heresy. Having banned Butlerov from giving a lecture in 1883, the Orthodox Church's most senior bureaucrat, Konstantin Pobedonosev, denounced, "Mr. Butlerov's lectures will awaken doubtless a newspaper polemic of a very seductive character. Devout people will come from these lectures and polemics into great temptation and will begin to grumble that the government should allow superstition in public display. It is the duty of the Orthodox Church to condemn the popular fascination with the supernatural." But let us now return to Lichensi and Father Ioan Solovyov in 1900. Was an explanation ever found? And what happened to the doomed priest? Ultimately, the police investigating the case moved away from the idea that a mediumistic maid was the source of the haunting, but the fault instead being found in Solovyov's personality. Once a heavy drinker, Solovyov was notably of a nervous disposition. It was therefore proposed that Solovyov was in fact a victim of hypnosis. However, this idea was never put to the test. Before any further digging could be done, Solovyov and his family moved to another village, and the haunting in Lichensi came to an end. As argued by Julia Mannhertz, the scholar from whose book I take this tale, the various stories of haunted houses in the late empire share some key details in common. First, they very often involve people of some social stature. From the examples mentioned in this episode, we find two priests, an army officer, and an affluent peasant. Affirming the reality of the haunting in these cases therefore gave participants and readers an opportunity to ridicule their immediate social betters and delight in their misfortunes. Second, the way in which spirits consistently mocked or attacked the Orthodox clergy and their rituals was no doubt cathartic in a state that prohibited the public satire of Orthodoxy as blasphemy and desecration. Third, maids, servants, and nannies are a continual feature in the narratives, often being blamed as the cause of the troubles by acting as gateways for dark forces. In an era when domestic servants, especially female ones, were incredibly cheap and therefore present in even fairly humble homes, the notion that these perennially unpaid and mistreated employees might be capable of upending both household and social hierarchies through either deliberate or accidental recourse to magical and mystical means would undoubtedly prove somewhat upsetting to readers. This gave these reports, otherwise little more than tabloid doggerel, that alluring edge of the uncanny and the unsettling that all the best ghost stories offer. That sense that one's understanding and world are not as secure as it seems, that reality is not quite as solid as we might like to assume. In the late Russian Empire, where long-established social and economic orders were being undermined by new technologies, political movements, and scientific discoveries, the feeling of a trembling, vanishing reality was all too familiar to many. But this, dear friends, is a tale for another time.